These lectures are titled The History of the United States, Part 7. Lecture 73, The Civil Rights Movement.
Last time we looked at American abundance in the post-war world. Now let's consider the great exception to that abundance, the African-American community, and the way in which the civil rights movement of the 50s and early 60s began to transform its prospects. The Supreme Court's decision in the Brown case, 1954, and then the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955-6, inaugurated the legal and activist phases of the civil rights movement. By 1965, a combination of lobbying, direct action, and shifts in public sympathy had eventuated in the complete legal abolition of racial segregation. Martin Luther King Jr. and the other movement leaders were nearly all evangelical clergy, bringing the style and idiom of their worship to bear on a pressing public question. The defenders of segregation promised massive resistance to these changes, but in the event, they gave way quickly, with only a tiny minority offering active or violent resistance. Success for the civil rights movement, however, did little to alleviate disparities in income and opportunity for African Americans. The next stage of the movement, with disputes over busing and affirmative action, was clouded by bitter political disagreements. The Interracial Civil Rights Coalition, meanwhile, broke up in the face of militant black power in the mid and late 1960s. Well, first of all, the Brown decision, Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, which the Supreme Court decided in 1954. It was the culmination of a long period of legal struggle for desegregation, led by the legal department of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Already, auguries of racial change were coming about. After the Second World War, for example, the American military abandoned racial segregation. A government committee report called To Secure These Rights, published in 1947, condemned America's racial policy as intolerable and in violation of national principles. So President Truman took the step of abolishing racial segregation and discrimination in the armed forces in 1948 and also in federal hiring. That means that when the American Army went to war in Korea, it was desegregated, whereas it had been segregated during World War II. The election of 1948 was also a very important moment in the development of, or in indicators that the racial situation was changing. The Democratic Party of 48 divided on the civil rights question. Hubert Humphrey, who was then the mayor of Minneapolis, gave a passionate speech on behalf of civil rights. He said, quote, "The time has arrived for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadow of states' rights and walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights." In other words, states' rights is the shelter behind which Southern segregationists maintain their policies, and we ought no longer to permit them to do so. Well, that led to fervent applause from some, particularly Northern Democrats. But it also led to some Southern Democrats walking out of the convention completely to create an alternative political movement and to run their own candidate for president. This was Strom Thurmond, who became the Dixiecrats candidate for president in that election year. Now, 1948 was probably the most surprising presidential election of the entire 20th century, because the Democratic Party appeared to be breaking up both right and left. The Dixiecrats, that is, Southern white segregationists, walked out. Another group who left the Democratic Party were the Henry Wallace Progressives. Henry Wallace had been Roosevelt's vice president in 1940 through 44, but he was far less antagonistic to the Soviet Union than most of the Democratic mainstream. And in fact, he was widely regarded as being a communist sympathizer. Wallace thought the Cold War was unnecessary and that appropriate acts of conciliation by the Americans could have prevented the Cold War situation, which already by 48 was serious. So the conventional wisdom in 1948 was this: Truman is bound to lose and the Republican Dewey is going to win, because after all, the Democratic Party has been split to the right and to the left. Well, in an astonishing election upset, Truman won anyway. And there's a very famous photograph of him holding up a newspaper. I think it's the Chicago Tribune. The headline says, Dewey defeats Truman, when he just heard that, in fact, the opposite was true, that Truman himself had beaten Dewey. So it's a warning to newspaper editors not to be too confident about the pre-election polls. Now, Truman's victory showed that a pro-civil rights stance of the kind that Hubert Humphrey had advocated was not necessarily politically destructive. An important moment. Also, the previous year, 1947, Major League Baseball had been desegregated by the inclusion of Jackie Robinson, a brilliant, a talented young black player, by the Dodgers. So, not in itself a major step, but certainly symbolically very important, because from then on, the arrival of talented black athletes in all the Major League sports accelerated rapidly. The Brown case in 1954 had immense consequences, because it indicated that American schools, and in fact potentially all American public facilities, must now be desegregated where they'd been racially segregated ever since the 1890s, a decision which had been upheld, remember, back in 96 by the Plessy versus Ferguson decision. So the Brown case delighted civil rights advocates and horrified segregationists. The court, under the leadership of Earl Warren, used sociological and psychological evidence to show that separate education for a racial minority was inherently unequal. In other words, even if the black schools had been just as good as the white schools, the fact that they were separate was itself discriminatory and would be harmful, and therefore, the court said, must be eliminated. Now, President Eisenhower had appointed Earl Warren to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and he'd thought of Warren as a safe appointment. After all, it was Earl Warren who had interned the Japanese Americans back in the early 1940s when his job had been as Attorney General of California. So he committed what now looks like one of the very worst civil rights violations in American history, interning the Japanese, although they'd committed no crimes. Now here he is clearing the way to the removal of the structure of racial segregation. A series of cases had preceded the Brown case, the so-called graduate schools cases, but their main impact had been to ensure that separate schools really must be equal. But the Brown case says even that is no longer good enough. Southern states were busy building much, much higher quality schools for their African-American children in the knowledge that if they didn't, they were going to be defeated on those grounds. But they started it too late. The decision, as I said, emphasized the inherent inequality of separation. The following year, in a decision called Brown 2, the court said that school desegregation should now take place with, quote, all deliberate speed. That's an ambiguous phrase, because being deliberate about something could mean that you're actually doing it rather slowly. And certainly the defenders of racial segregation took it in that light. So most of the southern states, where segregation had been the law, was the law, dragged their feet and did everything they could to delay the reality of racial integration. And the Southern congressional delegations got together to declare a policy of massive resistance. That is, they'd do everything they could to prevent the racial integration of their institutions. Well, the activist phase of the civil rights movement followed almost at once. Martin Luther King Jr. became famous for his leadership in the Montgomery bus boycott, which began in December 1955 and went on throughout almost the whole of the next year. The buses in Montgomery, Alabama, were segregated. And Rosa Parks, who was a local member of the NAACP, agreed that she'd challenged the local segregation laws. She was a black woman, by sitting in an area which was reserved for white passengers. Sure enough, she was arrested for violation of the town's laws governing who sat where on the buses. And the NAACP, the women who led it actually, arranged a protest meeting which called for the boycott. And they appointed Martin Luther King, a Baptist minister who'd been in town for just about a year, to lead it. There's a book by Joanne Robinson called The Montgomery Bus Boycott and the Women Who Started It. And she emphasizes that it was Rosa Parks and women like herself who got the movement started, and then handed leadership of it on to mainly the black clergy in their districts. Regular church meetings of the boycott people maintained community solidarity during the year-long boycott. King's great fear, of course, was that at first, in a fever of enthusiasm, people would get off the buses and refuse to ride. But gradually, the need to get to and from their jobs and the convenience of being able to ride the bus would lead them to get back on. So he needed a way to maintain community solidarity. And it was done through the churches. Two or three times a week, they'd have big prayer services, get together, sing evangelical songs. He'd preach passionate sermons, most of whose content was religious, but just with a political message at the end. It was that which kept the movement going and kept the boycott successful. King himself endured death threats. People fired guns at his house. A bomb threat, and so on. He also helped to organise carpools to enable black workers who worked far from their homes to be shipped from one place to another as an alternative to the buses. Listen to a little bit of his rhetoric. This is one of the speeches he made at the time. Quote, "Our method will be that of persuasion, not coercion. Our actions must be guided by the deepest principles of our Christian faith. Love must be our regulating ideal. Once again, we must hear the words of Jesus echoing across the centuries. Love your enemies, bless those that curse you, and pray for them that despitefully use you. If we fail to do this, our protest will end up as a meaningless drama on the stage of history, and its memory will be shrouded with the ugly garments of shame. In spite of the mistreatment we have confronted, we must not become bitter and end up by hating our white brothers. If you will protest courageously and yet with dignity and Christian love, when the history books are written in future generations, the historians will have to pause and say, there lived a great people, a black people, who injected new meaning and dignity in the veins of civilization. This is our challenge and our overwhelming responsibility." After the successful conclusion of the Montgomery bus boycott, in which the city agreed to desegregate the buses, King wrote a book about it called Stride Towards Freedom. And in the book, he speculates on why it should have been Montgomery that the movement started. He says, is it because there was a big desegregated Air Force base outside Montgomery so that the example of integrated living was available? Is it because the NAACP was so active? Is it because I was there? And King says, well, it was all those things. But above all, it was because God chose Montgomery. Of course, secular historians are uneasy with reasoning like that because you can't test God's will empirically. But certainly, there's no question that King's own religious faith sustained him and that he saw it as a Christian movement. Now, in the following years, civil rights groups mounted campaigns wherever they thought it was likely that they were going to be able to get a confrontation with the defenders of segregation so that there would be conflict. Because when there's conflict, you get press coverage and publicity. In other words, they didn't want to waste their energy in campaigns which were going to be routine and wouldn't get any news. They understood that the power of the media to spread the word of what was going on was central to their cause. Sit-ins at lunch counters began in Greensboro, North Carolina, trying to desegregate areas of stores which at the moment were racially segregated. The freedom rides on interstate buses, which provoked white aggression by supporters of segregation. And every time one of these events was going to take place, a sit-in or one of the freedom rides, the organizers would call journalists ahead of time, both the print and the visual media, so that when confrontation came, the journalists could witness the white segregationalists' violence against the demonstrators. King's own organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and others, the Congress of Racial Equality and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, all practiced nonviolence. That is, they'd have training sessions where their members learned how to encounter racist violence without fighting back. And it took a lot of self-discipline, as you can imagine. Your temptation when you're attacked would be to strike out in return. And so King and his followers trained on resisting the temptation to fight back, however great, however severe the provocation became. They were borrowing the insights of Gandhi and Mohandas Gandhi and the Indian independence movement, which had won independence from the British Empire 10 years previously. Gandhi himself, who'd been educated in Britain, understood perfectly that he could use the Brits' own bad consciences against them. That non-violence was a very effective weapon if the opponent did have a conscience. It wouldn't have worked against an adversary like Hitler, but it did work against the British Empire, whose own defenders got increasingly bad consciences. The same was true, of course, with King. His Christian rhetoric and his use of the Bible was very skillful, because it was a Bible which both black and white people honoured, for the most part. So when King would read a Bible, or quote a Bible passage, and then say, here's what it means in this context, very often the members of his white audience were forced to agree with him as well and to look at the issue in a new way through the shared language of the Bible which they had. And because non-violence was maintained for the most part in these demonstrations, the demonstrators were able to maintain the moral high ground. If you look at who the leaders were, you find they were nearly all evangelical clergymen. Ralph Abernathy, King himself, Fred Shuttlesworth, a little bit later Andrew Young, Jesse Jackson, and so on. Now, in the city of Atlanta, the politicians there realized what the civil rights movement was doing. They were provoking confrontations in order to get publicity. So Mayor William Hartsfield of Atlanta, the man after whom the Atlanta airport is now named, in 1961 gathered together black and white community leaders and worked out a peaceful desegregation plan. He himself had been perfectly willing to live with segregation, but now he was perfectly willing to live with desegregation. In other words, for him, it wasn't a make or break issue. And in fact, Atlanta was able to take advantage of desegregating itself peacefully as a way of promoting its own image nationwide. Atlanta called itself the city too busy to hate. So on the day that Atlanta's public schools were desegregated, busloads of journalists from all over the country were invited to Atlanta, and at the city's expense were taken around some of the new schools and institutions which were being peacefully desegregated as a way of showing, we know how it can be done, how it can be done peacefully. All done with very careful preparation, of course, in the schools and the police force and everywhere else. Now, by then, John F. Kennedy was president. He'd won the election of 1960. The Kennedy government dragged its feet on the question of desegregation. Why? Well, because Kennedy understood that the reason Democrats won elections was because they got the votes of the solid South, that is, the vast majority of the white voters in the South. Most of them were segregationists, and therefore the abandonment of segregation might mean that white Southerners would no longer vote Democratic, in which case, of course, he wouldn't win re-election in 1964. So although Kennedy was certainly dismayed at some of the actions which were being taken to prevent desegregation, nevertheless, he didn't throw himself very wholeheartedly into the campaign for desegregation. In fact, ironically, Martin Luther King had a much higher opinion of Richard Nixon, Eisenhower's vice president, than he had of President Kennedy. Well, one of the most memorable campaigns of the entire civil rights movement was in Birmingham, Alabama, at Easter time in 1963. And this is because the Commissioner of Public Safety in Birmingham was a man called Bull Connor, a racist, segregationist diehard. And King was confident that Connor would overreact, that he'd react violently, and in doing so put himself on the worst possible moral footing and put the demonstrators on the best possible moral ground. And that's exactly what happened. It was in Birmingham that Bull Connor used attack dogs and fire hoses to attack the demonstrators. Of course, it's both bad news and good news. It's bad news in the sense that it leads to massive arrests and it's very painful to be attacked in this way. But it's good news in the sense that it gets TV news, an enormous nationwide reaction in favour of the desegregationists. It was while he was in prison himself, arrested by Bull Connor's men, that King wrote the letter from Birmingham jail, which has since become one of the great classic statements of the civil rights movement. And he argued that these events in Birmingham were not only of parochial interest. One of the things that King was so good at was to say, look, here we are, we're in this shabby part of a little southern town. It might look as though it's just a backwater, but it's not. It's got global implications. He quotes from Jesus and St. Paul and St. Augustine and Socrates and numerous theologians to show that issues of absolutely the first importance are at stake here in Birmingham. And of course, it has become a classic statement of the movement from then right up to the present. A little bit later that year, 63, segregationists attacked some Birmingham churches with bombs, and in one particularly horrible attack, four young girls in Sunday school classes were killed in the explosions. Well, the Birmingham bombings finally galvanized the Kennedy administration into action. The Attorney General was Robert Kennedy, the president's brother. And he realized that after an outrage of this magnitude, it was no longer possible for the Justice Department to drag its feet, as even it had been doing to some extent. He also recognized that now the philosophy of states' rights was completely discredited. After all, in itself, there may be nothing wrong with states' rights, but the degree to which the philosophy had been used to justify racial segregation had progressively discredited it. So it was harder and harder for anyone to say, I'm genuinely interested in the separation of powers, because it had so transparently become a shelter behind which segregationists could rest. In August of 1963, King made the electrifying speech at the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, which is perhaps his single most famous statement, a beautiful blending of biblical passages from the book of Isaiah with the words of the song My Country, 'Tis of Thee, again to make the case that the Bible and American national tradition and the aspirations of the African-American people all harmonize in their aspirations for freedom. The next year, 1964, he was given the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize, and this made him a world-famous figure. Now, imagine what was going on in the Soviet Union at the same time. All through the civil rights movement, Soviet newspapers regularly had as their headlines descriptions of whites attacking blacks in the American South. See, it was the civil rights confrontations provided a great propaganda opportunity to the Soviet Union, because they could say, the Americans claim to be on the side of freedom. Look what they're doing to their own citizens. You see, this is also a period where very rapidly the European powers are decolonizing Africa. The British Empire in Africa was completely dismantled in the 50s and 60s. And both the Americans and the Russians are hoping to get the newly independent African nations on their side. It's going to be very hard to persuade new self-governing black African nations to join America if the African American people themselves are clearly being victimized at home. In other words, the government begins to realize what's going on at the moment is very, very costly in terms of the Cold War propaganda war, in addition to all the other considerations we have to bring to it. Now, an alternative route to black self-expression and dignity was offered by the black Muslim movement. Elijah Muhammad was its leader, and Malcolm X was its most famous spokesman. The Nation of Islam, beginning in obscurely in the 1930s, offered a kind of mirror image of white racism. According to its teachings, the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, the reason white people had ever come into existence in the first place was because they were the outcome of a strange genetic experiment by a mad scientist called Dr. Yacoub, who'd has selectively bred people to get the pigmentation out of their skin until he'd perfected a race of white devils who he'd created to be a torment to black people. So many of the strange racial arguments which were made for white supremacy by white racists, their antithesis was made by some of the black Muslims. But certainly it was a very effective movement in restoring dignity to African Americans who were living in a degraded way. It was very effective, for example, in recruiting prisoners. If you joined the black Muslims, you had to abandon drugs and stimulants of all kinds. You had to live a clean and dignified life, dress respectably, work hard, and demonstrate by your deportment that you stood up for yourself and believed in black assertion, rather than the conciliatory message of Christian love, which King emphasized so strongly. Malcolm X became the most influential advocate of black separatism, and criticized King's version of racial integration, which he thought was misguided. He said, Malcolm X says at one point in a TV interview, this is in about 62 or 63, he says, well, the civil rights movement is like coffee. At first it was black and it woke everybody up. But as it's becoming more and more integrated, it's like adding too much milk to the coffee. It's becoming whiter and whiter. When the interviewer asked him if he was an extremist, as many people alleged, Malcolm X answered, yes, I'm an extremist. The black race here in North America is in extremely bad condition. You show me a black man who isn't an extremist, and I'll show you one who needs psychiatric attention. Well, he was a brilliantly articulate speaker, himself a man of great dignity of bearing, whose uncompromising speeches, so much at variance with King's, sent a wave of fear through American white communities, and certainly made King seem, by comparison, a mild and mainstream advocate of reform, whom the community could easily reach out to accept. Malcolm X was assassinated after abandoning Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam and moving towards a version of mainstream Islam from which until then it had been very different. And there's some evidence that his own ideas were changing and that he would have been a little bit less uncompromising had he lived longer. But unfortunately, there was no chance for these ideas to be worked out because of his premature death. This was just after he'd collaborated with Alex Haley to write the autobiography of Malcolm X, a great African-American classic. Well, legally sanctioned racial segregation disappeared quickly, but efforts to destroy de facto segregation proved far more difficult to eliminate. Massive resistance, which the Southern congressmen had said they were going to practice, collapsed quickly. Really, the only place where it was put into effect for long was in Prince Edward County, Virginia, where the public school system was closed down altogether in 1958 rather than be racially integrated. And instead, white parents started to build their own private schools for their kids to go to instead. But it wasn't a policy which lasted very long. In the end, the absurdity of such a policy forced itself on the citizens' attentions and they decided to abandon it. What most school districts did instead, especially those which were reluctantly accepting the logic of integration, was to do token racial integration. That is, in classes which were still overwhelmingly white in composition, they'd permit one or two black students to enter, usually the ones who were very, very best intellectually, academically, or the very best athletically. And by making token integration, hoped that they could postpone rigorous enforcement of the law to make them do more than that. And in fact, that's a policy which continued right through the 1960s in some deep southern districts. Two important acts of Congress changed the legal situation. The Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Acts of 1964 and 65 completely abolished racial categories. And it was in the same year, 65, that the Immigration Reform Act was passed, ending the racial discrimination which was practiced in immigration policy, so that from 65 to the present, a much greater migration of non-Northern European peoples could come into the country as well. So a very, very important years in the early stages of the Johnson administration. In Freedom Summer, the summer of 1964, black and white students together went to Mississippi to register large numbers of black voters whose families hadn't had the right to vote for 60 or 70 years. But unfortunately, in the 1960s, a series of inner-city riots broke out in the black communities, the long, hot summers of the 60s. And these race riots did immense harm in destroying the good feeling and the high-mindedness which had accompanied the civil rights movement up until then. One of the reasons, well, people speculated on the reasons for the riots, but perhaps one of them was that gaining the abstract right to vote and to no longer be subject to segregation, although it was welcome, couldn't in itself destroy disparities of income, which were still very great. Listen to Lewis Lomax, an angry young radical in 1967. Quote, "By marching, singing, praying, and suffering, Martin Luther King led America out of the prison of legal segregation. Only after the prison walls fell was it fully laid bare that the inmates of segregation had been maimed for life. Their tortured souls could be heard groaning in agony and despair from Mississippi to Cleveland, from Georgia to Watts," that's the ghetto of Los Angeles, "from Alabama to Harlem. King had opened the door, but the newly freed men were too crippled by experience to walk in." The worst year of these riots was 1967, when 41 different American cities erupted in rioting behavior, worst of all in Washington, D.C. itself, just a few blocks from the White House, and in Newark, New Jersey, and in Detroit. Well, it wasn't long before the government began to enforce the Civil Rights Act of 1964 with affirmative action programs. Even though the language implied complete color blindness, affirmative action obviously identified people by racial category, but now tried to discriminate in African Americans' favor rather than discriminating against, as had previously been the case. But that in turn led to a very severe white backlash from citizens who felt that it was unjust. As busing policies to enforce actual school desegregation spread, And as affirmative action in hiring spread, white citizens' resistance to it also increased. Militant white parents and students attacked school buses in Boston, for example, and set fire to them. And meanwhile, white flight in residential patterns set in, with whites getting away from areas in which their children were going to be compelled to go to racially integrated schools. Some observers even said that desegregation plus white flight might have made life in the inner city ghettos worse than ever, because now it was possible for the successful black middle class to move away to the suburbs along with the white flight people, where previously they'd been confined in racial ghettos, where they'd been able to act as a leadership elite, families like King's own. This is a very bitter, unforeseen side effect. Campaigns against affirmative action intensified. In 1978, the Supreme Court heard the Baquet case, which was a direct challenge to affirmative action. Alan Baquet, a white man, was twice rejected for admission to the University of California Davis Medical School, even though it had accepted less qualified minority candidates. And the case demonstrated that the school reserved 16 out of its 100 annual places for minority students. The Supreme Court in that decision outlawed rigid racial quotas, but did uphold the general principle of affirmative action that an employer and a school should do what it could to try to make sure that its student body or its employee body was racially diverse in the same way that the population was. Well, attacks on affirmative action continued, particularly in the white community, although also among some Asian Americans in the 80s and 90s. And by the end of the millennium, the end of the century, affirmative action programs themselves were in retreat in most parts of America. The black population was still less upwardly mobile than many other groups in America, and still often bypassed by new immigrants whose groups arrived and very rapidly climbed the socioeconomic ladder in America. It remained America's most intractable problem, the subject of immense heart-searching, immense research projects, and vehement political conflicts. But I don't think anybody could deny that, for all its shortcomings, the American racial situation was vastly better by the end of the century than it had been in the era of racial segregation.